like I said, she was 17 years old. I went over to Walnut Creek to the department and talked to the lieutenant and told him, I said, this is East Area Rapist, but this is not the person he was after, and he's going to hit you again. And I was told at that time, we handle our own cases. We don't need your help. We don't need your task force. I told him, I said, no, you have got to understand, this is not who he was after. He did not know that she was at that house. He just happened to be going by on his way to the person he was after. Again, I was told, we don't need your help. And I left. That stayed with me. June the 25th, he hit a 13-year-old. And that 13-year-old was the one that he was after to begin with. She had never had a boyfriend. She didn't know anything about sex. The way that he treated those two girls was the same way that he treated all the others before them. Tied them up, tied them tight, threatened to kill them. And I believe at that time that he would have if they hadn't gone along with exactly what he told them to do.
I get it every time. Was there something you could have done that you did not? And there was not. The things that we put our victims through, you can just imagine. People have no idea what rape victims go through. I always have my clothes laid out, ready to jump into my clothes and be in the car and drive 90 miles an hour to get somewhere. And of course, you don't have traffic like you have now. But then I would go in. Our victim has already been raped. And so I'm taking her into the bedroom. And I said, look, we're going to try to collect some fingerprints. Tell me everywhere he touched you. A new technique had been developed where you pick up fingerprints off the body. And actually, they only last for a very short period of time. It's a process of iodine fuming. And you have a vial and you are heating it up and you're making it warmer. And then you blow. And a smoke comes out and you iodine fume. And then they quit doing it because it was carcinogenic. So there was nothing that we didn't try to do at that time. Now, remember, in the 70s, we didn't have 911. There was not a number where somebody could call and get an answer right away. We didn't have cell phones. Officers on the street had to stop at restaurants or pay phones. We had to keep quarters with us, or nickels, I think, dimes at the time, to make phone calls.
The East Area Rapist was not the most active rapist in California at that time. In 1973 through 1976, they had one called the Early Morning Rapist, and he committed 36 rapes and was never identified. Don't know where he went. The Woolly Rapist, he would count to 100 backwards and place them in a closet. The Pillowcase Rapist, and he attacked 54 women between 1976 and 1978. The San Diego Rapist, he had 30 rapes. The Stinky Rapist in Berkeley, all the victims said that he had an odor. They just called him Stinky. The Car Key Rapist, one that would rape them in their car, and then he would take their car keys and run. There was probably 8-10 rapists that were active at that time, but they were not trying to kill people and not threatening to kill people. They were doing it for the sex. East Area Rapist was doing it for the terror that he could put in their minds.
The East Area Rapist seemed to be reading the news about himself. And there was far more news about him than any other serial offender at the time. Sometimes the articles quoted the detectives who were chasing him. Would the East Area Rapist try to terrorize them too? How else do we explain what happened to Richard Shelby?
He was in the roof of our house that one night in May of 77. What had happened, our son woke us up. I remember that, and he was really scared. He saw a guy hang upside down. Him was a little, like a knit cap with a little ball hanging off the end. He used to have little balls on a string and it wiggled back and forth. That's how he saw it. And then he shined that flashlight across the bedroom once. He says he heard him on the roof, saw him do that, and he said he danced all around that roof like he wanted somebody to find him. You know, I don't know who else would be. And I wondered, did he know whose house he was on top of when he was on my house? Probably did. I had an unmarked car sitting right there in the driveway. He could have been just screwing with me. He could have wanted me to come out with a gun on me and do his thing.
There was no question that the East Area Rapist was getting under the skin of law enforcement. And it wasn't just law enforcement. Everyone in the community looked at their neighbors differently. Everyone was a suspect. But it was those uniformed officers that had the task of checking out every tip they received. And along the way, they had some suspects that looked very promising.
In December 77, we chased the guy down the 1 Avenue wearing a ski mask. And they lost him. And you think, maybe that was East Area Rapist. They don't really know. But they found a bicycle.
We knew at the time that the East Area Rapist was a non-secretor.
An offender's secretor status is, well, maybe I'll let Paul Holes answer that one for you.
The secretor status is related to one's blood type in the ABO system. So most people are aware that they are either a blood type A or a blood type B or blood type O, etc. But there's a small percentage of the population that we call non-secretors. And even though their blood type will test for type A, you don't find their blood type in their saliva or their semen. It just comes up as negative.
So what we would do with people like this is trying to get them to chew on gauze, and we turn it in and find out if they were a non-secretor.
Detective Larry Crompton had a great suspect that they thought might be the East Area Rapist, but they couldn't get his blood type to find out whether he was a non-secretor.
I was with him several times, and he refused. And one time we even went to his mother's place to try and contact him, and she told us, stay away from him. If you want anything, you go through his attorney. I have an attorney for him, and stay away from him. So we stayed with it. And a couple more times, I was in contact with him. Then I was told by the sheriff, we had a restraining order against me, and I was supposed to stay away from him. That made it a little difficult. So I found out where he was staying with his girlfriend, and I said, we'll go talk to him. I got him out of the house and was talking to him, and he was yelling at me and said, I got a restraining order against you. You're not supposed to talk to me. And I told him, I said, look, I know you're not the rapist. I'm doing this to clear you. He continued to yell at me. So I asked my partner if he would go to the car for a while, let me talk to him. He did. And I told this person, I said, okay, now I know you've got dope in the house in there. I know it's your girlfriend's house. So when I call narcotics, she's going to go to prison and it's going to be your fault. So I'm going to ask you for the last time to chew on the gauze. I just want to clear you. And he said, well, if I chew on the gauze, are you going to call narcotics? And I said, no. I said, I don't care about the dope that you have in the house. All I want to do is eliminate you. I gave him the gauze and he chewed on it. And then I went back to the car and with my buddy, and he said, how in heck did you get him to do that? Well, I told him that I would call narcotics and they'd get the dope. You seen dope? And I said, no, but I know he was a dope smoker. So he knew he must have some in there. So I just told him I knew that he had it in there and I would call it on him. So we got the gauze, turned it in. He was a secretor, so that cleared him. Sometimes you go through more than what you should, but we did it. I went to the Vacaville Medical Center where they have prisoners, and I talked to a doctor there that works with the rapists that are in prison. And I gave her 3 reports, and she said, come back next week. And she said, I'll talk to my rapist, and we'll see what we can come up with. So I went back and she said, you had better catch him. Said, he wants to kill. And she said, my rapist here said that he's given them a bad name. And I said, what? And she said, you got to understand who I deal with here. She said, they don't think they hurt people. But in going over these, they all agree that he is dangerous. He wants to kill. And she said, in my mind, he will not be taken. That he will kill you or he will kill himself.
Chapter 4, Investigating a Hunch.
So right now we're here in Sacramento. This is the hub of the East Area Rapist series. This is where he started. He attacked 29 times here. All of his attacks were occurring in the East Area of the Sacramento region. That's how he got this moniker, East Area Rapist.
The East Area Rapist attacked 29 times in Sacramento and 21 times in other cities around the area, including 8 times in Contra Costa County, where Paul Holes began his career as a criminalist. At almost all of these attacks, the East Area Rapist leaves semen containing his DNA. This evidence is routinely collected and stored in sexual assault kits. However, DNA science isn't advanced enough to make use of it. But eventually, the science will catch up. The only question is whether law enforcement has the foresight to preserve the evidence. As the years go by and the East Area Rapist case goes unsolved, the rapes are no longer prosecutable because of the very short statute of limitations on rape at the time. So according to protocol, all of the DNA evidence is now gone. Flash forward about 20 years to 1994. Technically, Contra Costa County's East Area Rapist evidence was scheduled to have been destroyed at least 10 years earlier. Paul has just dusted off the red EAR files he found in his home away from home, the crime library in Martinez.
So I'm reading through the case files, and it's attack after attack in Contra Costa County, starting in October of 1978 in Concord. Because these cases were well past statute of limitations, property rooms have a tendency to destroy evidence once the case can no longer be prosecuted. So I hit up Sheriff's property room and asked them, can you pull the evidence from these cases? And they're busy. They said, well, we can't get to that right now. And the Sheriff's property room was just a few blocks away. So I went down there myself. This run-down two-story warehouse wasn't very big, and they had kept their evidence on sexual assaults and homicides up on the second floor, which in an air-conditioned building in the summertime is horrible for evidence, in particular biological evidence, and that biological evidence is being cooked. I sure hope if they have any evidence on East Area Rapist case, it hasn't been stored up there on the second floor. I end up going into this property warehouse and have them pull the 3x5 index cards that every single item in that warehouse has listed. In particular, I'm looking for sexual assault kits because back in 1978 and 1979, after these victims had been raped, their bodies had been processed for sexual assault evidence. Now, this is in the days before DNA, so they weren't trying to get DNA. They were just trying to find out, did the rapist leave his evidence, his semen, his saliva? I wanted to find those swabs with East Area Rapist semen and then try to do DNA. This is a dusty environment. They've had issues with rats that would chew their way through the paper bags, particularly if anybody had ever submitted food stuff like cake and boxed it as evidence. That was a big no-no because these rodents would come in, they would find something like that and go after it. Upstairs, of course, is where the East Area Rapist evidence was being kept. So it had been cooked over the course of now almost 20 years. And that was a little disheartening to see. But I was able to locate 3 sexual assault kits, and I grabbed those and checked them out of the property room and then brought them back to the lab and started to just go through each sexual assault kit and examine the items and confirm that, oh, I've got semen in each of these 3 cases. I proceeded to do this old DNA technology, which was brand new at the time, and this was showing, okay, it's the same guy leaving his DNA in each of those 3 cases. The original investigators had linked these cases together based on MO, and that was something that I was questioning as to, well, could they really do that? The DNA proved that they were right.
In 1997, Paul is working the East Area Rapist case in his spare time. Again, none of these rapes are prosecutable because they're far beyond the statute of limitations, but Paul's undeterred. He wants to solve this case.
So at this point, I now have DNA from the East Area Rapist. And I'm excited about that. And I'm now going through all these files out of that old file cabinet, looking for names, looking for suspect names, trying to determine which of these suspects were the best suspects. And then my goal was to get DNA from them today and see what we can do. Unfortunately, I could not figure out from this list of hundreds of names I compiled which of these suspects were considered the best suspects. I realized that one of the original investigators was still working at the sheriff's office, and his name was Larry Crompton. So I decided, well, I'd give Lieutenant Crompton a call and pick his brain and see who he thought I should go get DNA from.
I'm Larry Crompton, and I was with the Contra Costa County Sheriff's Department, and I joined that in 1970, and I retired in 1998. I had 28 years in. I get a phone call from criminalist Paul Holes.
I explained who I was, because I'm just this snot-nosed kid in the department, and he is this authority figure as a lieutenant. And he was very gracious in taking my call.
Paul told me that he was a DNA expert. And he said, if you can give me some names, he said, I will go through the evidence we have here and see if I can connect the DNA.
He was like, Paul, that case I would love to see solved. I will tell you right now, we looked at thousands of people and we don't have a prime suspect in that case. And then said, you know, Paul, we thought that this guy went down to Santa Barbara and may have even killed a couple down there.
I said, Paul, I know of 5 homicides in Southern California. I said, they won't cooperate with me. I know they have evidence, and I know that their murderer is our rapist. I know it's the same person.
According to Sheriff Spokesman Bill Miller, the department sent an investigator to Santa Barbara last week to look into the December shootings of a physician and his psychologist girlfriend.
There was a major crime, of course. 2 people were murdered. But what they have there is just the evidence at the scene, which is a strong indication it could be the same man. Well, a lot of physical evidence at the scene was similar to what he did here in Sacramento.
As a young criminalist, Paul had never heard about any of these homicides in Southern California. What Larry Crompton tells him is brand new and highly intriguing information. But Paul wonders why Santa Barbara was so quick to quash any idea that the cases could be related.
This is where Ronald Reagan had kept his primary residence. So he thought it was possible that Santa Barbara authorities were trying to protect Ronald Reagan as he was marching towards the campaign to become president of the United States.
When I talked to Sergeant William Baker of the Santa Barbara Sheriff's Department, I got a very different view. Baker says it's routine for departments in different counties to discuss cases that might be related. But he says similarities between the Santa Barbara murders and the East Area Rapist case have been blown out of proportion.
So I decided, well, I'm going to call Santa Barbara. I hang up with Lieutenant Crompton, and I speak with a detective down there. Hey, you guys have some unsolved cases from late 1979, early 1980 that might be related to my East Area Rapist series? And that detective was like, no, we've gone down that road before. These cases aren't related. And he kind of shut me down on that line of inquiry. But the one thing that he did do is he said, I've heard Irvine PD is doing some DNA on a couple of cases that they have. You might want to talk to Irvine. Okay. You know, and I got a contact number for Irvine. It took me a couple of days to be able to finally land on a phone number with an individual that gave me a call back, and that turned out to be an investigator by the name of Larry Montgomery.
My name is Larry Montgomery. I worked for the Irvine Police Department starting in January of 1974.
He proceeded to tell me they had 2 cases, 2 women that had been killed, one in 1981 and one in 1986, and had linked those 2 cases together. So I got the name for the DNA analyst at Orange County Sheriff's Crime Lab, Mary Hong, from Larry Montgomery, and I gave Mary a call. And I ended up talking to her and explaining, I've got DNA profile results from 3 cases up here in Contra Costa County. I just want to check and see if your cases that you're working down there are possibly the same guy. Unfortunately, Mary's lab was actually more advanced than the Contra Costa County Sheriff's lab in terms of where they were at doing the DNA testing. We couldn't do a comparison. However, there was one marker that she had done that I had also done, and that was the same type I had. That was interesting, and I told Mary, I said, hey, once I'm doing this newer DNA technology that Orange County is doing, I'll give you a call back. And so I hang up with Mary, and this is now in 1997. It took 4 years before we got caught up with what Orange County was doing.
Paul has no control of one of the biggest problems in solving the Golden State Killer case, bureaucracy. This case spans 11 different counties. Each California county has its own sheriff's department, crime lab, budget, and priorities. Technically, Paul isn't even supposed to be investigating it. Paul has to wait, so for the next 4 years, he keeps the EAR files in a corner behind his desk and drags them with him whenever he's promoted or moves offices.
So we're heading south on I-680. We just passed over the Benicia Bridge and have descended into Contra Costa County. This is where I worked for 27 and a half years. We're passing through the city of Martinez. We're on the freeway right now. Contra Costa is the other coast. So right across the bay is San Francisco. It's the other coast from San Francisco.
Now, one of my primary responsibilities was responding out to crime scenes. I was a crime scene investigator, but I was a scientist at the same time. So as a criminalist, I was bringing out that scientific component to the field. Of course, we're responding to the most major of cases that are happening in Contra Costa County, your homicide cases. We'd go out to the officer-involved shootings. I also was stuck having to respond out to all these blasted drug labs, all these meth labs. I responded to hundreds of drug labs during the course of my career. The bane of my existence. Hated drug labs.
In 2001, the crime lab had gotten the new DNA technology up and running. So I assigned it out to a DNA analyst, Dave Stockwell. Mary Hong, I know you know Mary, give her a call. I had talked to her back in 1997, and she's got a case down there that she's doing some DNA on. I just want to see, could this be the same guy? And when he left, I fully expected it would come back and we would have eliminated any potential connection to Mary's Irvine cases. So he leaves, I go to my office for at least an hour just doing the routine administrative work that I was stuck doing now in this management position. I sense a presence. Dave has come back into my office, is standing in the doorway. And he said, well, I spoke with Mary, and we have the same DNA profile that she has in her homicide cases. I just kind of pushed back, and I was like, you're kidding. And he was like, no, it's the same. He's telling her, this is the profile I have. At this marker, I've got this type. And Mary goes, I've got that type. And he says, at this marker, I have this type. And Mary goes, I've got that type at that marker. And they literally started to read to each other the profile. This was March of 2001. That's when the East Area Rapist was identified as being the same offender that Southern California knew as the original Night Stalker. I knew nothing about who the original Night Stalker was, and Mary had given Dave a contact within the sheriff's office, a detective Larry Poole, and his phone number. So I am calling Larry Poole. I'm just thinking Mary just had the two Irvine PD homicides. Larry proceeded to say, no, we've got six cases that we know this guy did. And four of those cases are double homicides, in addition to the two single homicides out of Irvine PD. So this original Night Stalker had killed 10 people across six cases. And I'm telling Larry, that's huge. Because up here, what we have in Northern California with the East Area Rapist series is we have 50 attacks where the offender let all these victims live. And we've got names in these case files, and we have victims saying, this is what this guy looked like. This is what he told us about himself. And I said, that is huge for your homicide investigation. I immediately recognized, you know, anytime you're working a whodunit homicide, you're often chasing ghosts because the victims themselves can't tell you what this guy said, what he did, what he looked like. So I ended up compiling all the physical evidence that I could find and all the fingerprint cards from the East Area Rapist series. I sent those down to Larry Poole in Orange County.
There was no way that it could be proven until Paul Holes did that DNA. And that really opened up the investigation.
Chapter 5, No Witnesses.
Before we begin this chapter, we want to remind you that there are descriptions of violent crime and sexual assault in this story, and it may not be suitable for all listeners.
In 2001, Paul finally connected the East Area Rapist attacks to the original Night Stalker attacks, which was the first major break in this case. But what are the original Night Stalker attacks? When did they start? Where and why? To answer that, we need to look at his last attack as the East Area Rapist.
Right now, we're driving on I-80, heading out to the East Bay. We're going to go down to Danville. East on Sycamore Valley is where we have the very last attack in Northern California of East Area Rapist.
It's almost 4 in the morning on July 5th, 1979, when the male victim, a light sleeper, suddenly opens his eyes.
The rapist was standing there, pulling his ski mask over his head, so he didn't have a gun in his hand. So the man started screaming at him, yelling at him.
What the fuck are you doing in here? Get the fuck out of here. While this male is confronting the offender, who's just completely taken aback, the wife gets up and runs out of the bedroom and runs out of that residence. The East Area Rapist is standing there blinking at him like he's just completely befuddled. So after the wife runs out, now the East Area Rapist realizes, okay, I'm done here. He runs out and the husband runs out. You know, everybody's bailing out of that house. And he ends up bouncing over this fence and then running down a green belt that kind of snakes through this whole subdivision. And it looks like he parked his car on that main Sycamore Valley Road. He's sprinting back to his vehicle and getting out because he knows patrol is going to be notified because the victims are out. They're calling law enforcement, and he's at least got an advantage, having been on foot, to get to his vehicle and get out to 680 rapidly. And patrol is, of course, they're all focused in on this location here. In many ways, this husband had the best look face-to-face of the East Area Rapist at that time. And he was able to give the artist, sketch artist, accurate descriptions of the shapes of the eyes as well as the lips, and then of course the ski mask. And so with all the composites that we have up to this point, this composite with the ski mask is the one that I've always said that's the best composite we've got, because that's really what the victims were seeing. That is the last known attack in Northern California by the East Area Rapist.
The East Area Rapist loses control of the victims. They escape and may have seen his face. This prompts some detectives to fear that the East Area Rapist may now have a reason to do something he's been threatening to do all along. Kill.
I talked to two psychiatrists during the time, and they both felt the same way. He wants to kill, and he will. And when I asked the doctor, I said, why hasn't he? And she said, well, he hasn't found the justification. But once he finds the justification, that's what he's going to do. And he found the justification when the last attack in our area, the people got away. That was his justification. No one was ever going to get away from him again. And that's when he started killing.
In Sacramento in Contra Costa County, the rest of July 1979 passes without any East Area Rapist attacks. Then nothing in August. And nothing in September. Did he move?
Was he arrested? Is he dead? Everyone braces themselves for his return, but he never does. The July 1979 attack in Danville in Contra Costa County is the last attack of the East Area Rapist. He's gone south, and he starts to change his MO in one major way. He begins to kill. There will be no more witnesses. The East Area Rapist has now become the original Night Stalker. He won't be given that name until much later, but it's important to know that his next seven attacks from 1979 to 1986 are known as the original Night Stalker series. On October 1st, 1979, 6 hours south of Sacramento on the Pacific Coast Highway, he returns.
So down in Goleta, California, there's a couple asleep in their bedroom when a masked man comes in. He threatens to kill them, forces the man to lay face down, and throws bindings to the female and makes her tie the man up. She's tying her husband up. Once the husband is tied up, he goes over and ties her up and then proceeds to take her out to the front of the house. He lays her down, and after she's separated from her husband and laying down, she hears him pacing back and forth, and he's saying, "I'm going to kill him. I'm going to kill him this time. I'm going to kill him." She gets up and runs to the front door. The husband hears that. He gets up and hops out the rear slider door. At this point, the offender has lost control. Next door, an off-duty FBI agent happened to hear this commotion. He grabs his gun and runs out and sees the offender ride right in front of him on a bicycle and disappear down the street. The FBI agent jumps into his car and catches up with the offender, who then dumps his bicycle, starts hopping fences, and disappears.
Police in Santa Barbara have no clue that the most violent serial rapist in California history has just moved into their town. Then Larry Crompton's prediction that the East Area Rapist will start killing turns out to be true.
2 months later, Dr. Offerman and Dr. Manning are found shot to death in Dr. Offerman's condominium. The second attack happened just 2 blocks away. Dr. Robert Offerman was a doctor in the Santa Barbara area, and Dr. Deborah Manning was a psychologist out of Santa Maria. They were dating at the time, and Dr. Manning was staying overnight at Dr. Offerman's condominium. When Santa Barbara authorities go in, they see Dr. Offerman nude, laying at the foot of the bed. He's been shot multiple times. Dr. Deborah Manning is found face down on the bed. Her hands are bound behind her, and she's been shot a single time in the back of the head. Dr. Offerman at one point in time had his hands bound behind his back. It appears that the offender probably left the room, allowing Dr. Offerman to slip his bindings. And when the offender came back in, Offerman got up and tried to make a charge at the offender. This caused the offender to shoot Dr. Offerman multiple times. He goes over and shoots Deborah Manning a single time in the back of the head, and then runs out. Right next door to where the Offerman-Manning homicide occurred, there was a vacant condo. It appears the offender had broken into the vacant condo next door and was able to take his time. He's paying attention to Dr. Offerman and Dr. Manning's activities and then basically laid in wait until he could be confident of being able to silently get inside Offerman-Manning's condo and take control of the situation. So once he enters that condo thinking he's got them at the most optimal time, instead he loses control and ends up having to defensively shoot Offerman.
Investigators speculate that the murders of Offerman and Manning may be related to the East Area Rapist, but there seems to be more doubt than certainty.
When I talked to Sergeant William Baker of the Santa Barbara Sheriff's Department, I got a very different view. Baker says it's routine for departments in different counties to discuss cases that might be related. But he says similarities between the Santa Barbara murders and the East Area Rapist case have been blown out of proportion. The female victim in Santa Barbara was not raped.
To anyone who knows the East Area Rapist attacks as well as Larry Crompton and Paul Holes do, the similarities in the Offerman-Manning double homicide far outweigh the differences. Deborah Manning was bound, and all indications point to the attacker's intent to rape her. It's likely his plan was interrupted. But now, for the first time, he's not leaving any witnesses. He becomes a killer.
So I got those reports. I went over them. And in our mind, we knew that the attempted rape and the murder was the East Area Rapist, but nobody would believe us.
While law enforcement debates who's behind the Santa Barbara murders, the killer is about to find his stride.
So in the last Northern California attack in July of 79 in Danville, the offender loses control of those victims. He fails in that case. Then in his first attack down in Goleta, California in October of 79, he loses control. He fails the second time. Now, in the Offerman-Manning double homicide, Dr. Offerman's actions, getting up and charging him, forcing the offender to shoot him, causes him to again lose control of that situation. He has to kill Deborah Manning and run out. He does not complete what he wants to do in this case. That's three attacks in a row where he fails. Why doesn't he just stop? I mean, he's elevating the risk to himself with these failures. If he fails again for the fourth time and leaves witnesses alive, he could be caught. But he's got this inner compulsion. He has this need to get that power and control back, get that godlike aura. So he's going to offend again in order to recapture that feeling. That's what he wants. And in many ways, when he does offend again, and this is March 1980 with Lyman and Charlene Smith, this is his opus. This is the case that goes from beginning to end the way he wants it to go.
My name is Steve Rhodes. I'm an investigator with the Ventura County District Attorney's Office. Ventura is 30 minutes from Santa Barbara. In 1980, Ventura was your typical small town beach community. Everybody was real friendly, almost like a retirement community in a way. Very peaceful town. In 1980, I was an ambulance driver in the city of Ventura, and I was sent to the Smith residence when Lyman and Charlene were killed. So it was March 16th. Lyman's son, who was about 12 years old, came over to his father and his stepmother's house to mow the lawn. His parents' car was in the driveway, and he went up and banged on the front door and it got no answer. So he went around the house, found everything else locked up. He encountered a couple of gardeners working, and he asked them if they'd seen his father, and they had not. He went back to the front door, and it was unlocked. He could hear a buzzing sound coming from the back of the house, and he saw that the living room was kind of disheveled in a semi-ransacked attempt. He makes his way back to the bedroom where he's hearing this buzzing sound, and it's the alarm clock on his father's bedside table, and he can see the forms of bodies underneath the blanket. But he doesn't uncover the bodies. He leaves the house and he calls 911, and he tells the police dispatcher and the fire operator that he thinks his parents are dead. Fire and ambulance get dispatched along with the police. And entries made, and sure enough, both adults are found dead underneath the blanket. Then they're covered head to toe. You can't see them at all. House is locked down, and the criminal investigation begins. The crime scene is the master bedroom. There's a quilt laying over the victims, both of whom are face down on the bed. Both are tied hand and foot. Between the bodies is a chunk of firewood that was taken from a stack of firewood that was in the backyard. So the killer had brought this piece of wood into the house and bludgeoned both victims to death with the wood. And he had sexually assaulted Charlene.
These aren't your average victims. In fact, Lyman Smith was a former DA, and then Governor Jerry Brown was considering appointing him to Superior Court judge. This is what we would consider a low-risk victim. Both Lyman and Charlene Smith are well-known in the Ventura community.
The primary suspect in the murders is another well-known Ventura resident.
The original investigators really focused in on one of Lyman Smith's business partners, Joe Alsip, and Alsip is actually arrested for that murder.
Joseph Alsip freely admitted that, yes, he was at the Smith home on the evening of the 13th, and the police had determined that the murder had to have happened on the 13th because the number of newspapers that were piled up on the house when the bodies were discovered. Alsip had said he'd been there. He'd shared a beer and a little dinner with both Lyman and Charlene, and he had left. The detectives in Ventura didn't know anything about the murders in Goleta just the month before. So they were centered on Joe Alsip, whose fingerprints were on a drinking glass, and they wound up charging him with the murder. Regrettably, some informant came forward and made some false claims about Joseph's confession to the murder. This was an individual who craved recognition from the police, and Joe spent about a year in jail waiting for his day in court.
We're entering into Nigel Shores. This is where we are having to see the, or be confronted with the security. And this was in place at the time of the homicides. So I don't know if they're going to allow us in or not. Let me try something.
How you doing? Hey, I'm a retired investigator that investigated a case that occurred in this neighborhood. Would it be okay for us to just drive around?
You would have to be called in either by the community or the residents.
Okay.
Yeah,
and that's fine. I don't want you to have to,
That's the only way. It would have to be someone calling you in.
Okay.
If you get a hold of the office and talk to them, I'll give you the number if you want.
That'd be great. Thank you.
It's
949. Hi, Kara. My name is Paul Holes. I'm a retired investigator that investigated an old case that occurred in Nigel Shores way back when. This is regarding the homicide of Keith and Patrice Harrington on Cockleshell back in March of 1980. Sure. No, I can completely understand that. Nope, that's okay. It's a negative. Yeah. So here you have a security system. You have a gated community with a security system, and they have roving security in this neighborhood. Why would he choose to attack here? Because that elevates his risk. I think this is one of those cases where the victims may have been targeted. And it could be as simple as he saw Patrice out at a grocery store and followed her back. Don't know. But it is striking to me that he is choosing to go into this gated and secured community to commit this double homicide.
So in August 1980, down in Nigel Shores, Keith and Patrice Harrington are found bludgeoned to death in their bed. They're both face down. They've each have been hit multiple times in the back of the head with an unknown weapon. We don't know what that weapon is, though there is some thought that the weapon could have been a brass sprinkler head that was probably present within the garage of the house. It appears the offender walked out of that double murder with the weapon. So in this particular case, there's no evidence that he went through the house. He's not ransacking this location. In fact, Patrice's purse is untouched, and he commonly would go in the female victim's purses just to see what was in there, what he could steal, or get the names from their driver's licenses. This is a change for him. Usually, he is going in and he's opening up drawers and he's looking for the jewelry and the cash that he wants to take, the trinkets of souvenirs that he wants to be able to possess. But he doesn't do this in this case. He enters in, he commits this homicide, and then he leaves. He went in to kill. He accomplished what he wanted to do in this case. So my first opportunity to take a look at the crime scenes that occurred down in Orange County was when I took my family to Disneyland. My kids were young at the time. They needed to come back to the hotel room to take a nap. So once they were down for a nap, my wife is left in the hotel room. I sneak out and I go down and I visit the attack locations for Manuela Whittoon and Janelle Cruz. I realized it was only 20 minutes away. So I was able to drive down there, take a look at both those locations, and get back up to the hotel in time to take the kids back to Disneyland. While I'm driving around taking a look at those locations, I am feeling a bit rushed because I knew I had to get back or I'd be facing some angry eyes when I walked in that hotel room if I was late. Okay, so now he's had those three failures in a row and then aha, he's able to succeed. That attack goes the way he wants it to go. And then now he gets down to Nigel Shores with Keith and Patrice Harrington and he succeeds. In that case, it goes exactly the way he wants it to go. At this point, he is feeling empowered again. So right now, We are turning east on Southwood. This is going into the neighborhood where Manuela Whittoon was killed back in February of 1981 in Irvine, California. Back at the time of the Manuela Whittoon case, Irvine was a very, very small town. A lot of the land that we see today that is all filled and built up with commercial buildings, it was vacant at the time. It was all orchards. Manuela Whittoon's parents were from Germany. However, Manuela had been in the U.S. for a while. She and her husband had been married for a few years. I had heard that she had heard about these types of cases and was paranoid about possibly becoming a victim. And I have seen that in other cases.
So we're here on Columbus Drive in Irvine, California. This is where the February 1981 homicide of Manuela Whittoon occurred. In that particular case, it looked like the offender had been prowled through the neighborhood a little bit and ended up accessing the Whittoon backyard through going over the fence on the south side of the house. There was a shoe impression on the top of the neighbor's gas meter. It appears that he used as a step to look over the fence before he jumped over it and then probably got a sense where Manuela was inside the house. He used a screwdriver and pried the rear slider open, leaving the screwdriver on the patio. It was actually collected as an item of evidence.
Our job was to take the paint that's on that screwdriver, give it to the lab, and see if they can determine what type of paint that was.
Larry Montgomery was one of the original Irvine PD investigators on the case.
According to the victim's husband, David Whittoon, he had never seen that screwdriver before. So the assumption was, if he's telling the truth, that that screwdriver was brought by the suspect.
He entered into the residence. Manuela Whittoon's husband had been hospitalized with a virus and was not home on the evening of that attack. Manuela was probably asleep in her bed, and that's where he attacked her. He sexually assaulted her and ended up bludgeoning her. She's inside a sleeping bag, so it had been covering her head for some of the blows. Initially, the thought is, well, did the offender use the sleeping bag purposefully? But in talking to the husband, well, that's how Manuela would sleep. There is evidence that she had been bound. He had removed the bindings and actually took the bindings with him this time. So this was a change in his MO. In the previous cases, he either left the bindings on the victim or, in the Harrington case, had left them on the bed.
Some other issues on the Whittoon case were interesting and a little different. The answering machine for the phone was one of those that had one little tape recording in it for your messages to be put on when somebody left a message. It had another separate recording that was for a message that the Whittoons would leave on that for anybody who called. And it would usually say, you know, this is the Whittoons, leave a message. And then the other recording would record the message. Those two little areas where the tapes were opened and the tapes were gone. Why did he take those? Why would he actually need to take those two recordings unless maybe he left a message on it? Maybe he left a message and maybe Manuel knows him. And maybe after he killed her, he needed to take those in order not to be identified.
The husband had this reel-to-reel tape player. And when he comes home and he's looking at what had happened inside his house, he had noticed that a reel had been placed on that player. And he told the investigators, I didn't do that. So I start looking into the possibility, well, if the offender did that, why? Why is he putting that reel on there? Is he touching it with bare hands? Could we get his fingerprints off of that reel? Is there any magnetic tape where he may have recorded himself? Because that's something we know that this offender possibly could have done. He likes to call the victims. Maybe he left a recorded message. So when they played that tape, he's further tormenting the people who are listening to it. Unfortunately, no fingerprints were recovered off that reel. And when that reel was opened up from its original packaging, whatever magnetic tape had been on there, if any, wasn't there.
There was a TV, and not a good TV. It wasn't like a fancy TV. They had a better TV in the house. But an older, black and white looking big TV was taken out of the house by the killer and propped up against the wall in the back of the house.
So with this TV that had been taken out of the house and put on the back patio, one of the theories is that he may have needed to use that TV in order to get up over the fence. We know our offender is extremely capable of jumping fences. So at this point, Why would he need to use this TV to step on in order to be able to go over the fence? There was some thought and discussion amongst the investigators that, well, maybe because of his age and or injury, he was less physically capable at the time of the Manuela Huitoun attack and needed that TV sort of as a stepping stool to get up over the fence on his escape. However, when I take a look at this TV, I'm looking for evidence that it had been stepped on. I'm looking for disturbances to the top of the TV, whether it be structurally, whether it be a soil that had been left behind. I'm looking at the position of the TV relative to the fence. How far away is it? What I'm noticing is there does not appear to be any indicators that had been stepped on.
It certainly wasn't something you steal and take with you. So that seemed odd. So was that something that a person who really wasn't a burglar tried to make it look like it was a burglary? So that was a question that we had.
To some detectives at the time, the TV in the yard made the crime scene look staged.
Who needs to fake a scene? It would have to be somebody close who doesn't want to be identified who would fake a scene. Certainly her husband was somebody to look at as a possibility. Could it have been him? I was looking at exactly what David Whitehune did in the hospital. If he did it, he had to sneak out of the hospital and be gone for over an hour to get away, get home, kill his wife, get back, and risk somebody not seeing him for, you know, coming in and finding him gone and looking for him. Could he have done it if it in the middle of the night nobody went and checked him? Possibly. I did discover that they had phone records. The phone that was next to David Whitehune's bed at the hospital, and what I found very interesting and kind of from a humanistic, what do people do? I looked at the next morning, I think it was 7 o'clock. It showed he picked up the receiver and dialed his wife's phone number. And it was on for a certain amount of time, which I timed it. It was like about 8 rings that it would take before he hung up. And then he immediately picked up the phone. And I was thinking to myself, if I was in his position, if I'm innocent and I call my wife and I know she's supposed to be home and I let it ring 8 times, she doesn't answer. And what would I be thinking? I would be thinking, boy, did I misdial? She should be answering. And what he did is exactly what I would do. He immediately dialed the exact same number, and then he left it ringing for 20 times. And she didn't answer.
It's hard to know if the killer actually planned this attack with the husband being away, or whether it was just coincidence that the husband happened to come down sick and was in the hospital. We know this offender is not afraid to kill when there's a man present. We'll never know for sure if he planned to attack with the male outside the house, but if the husband was there that night, he probably would have been killed too.
Manuela Whitehoun is the 7th murder victim of the East Area Rapist. At this point in 1981, no one knows these murders are the work of a serial killer, let alone the East Area Rapist. The murders in Santa Barbara haven't been connected to Orange County or Ventura. There are no witnesses. DNA is not in use. The investigators have very little to go on. And no one knows whether this killer is going to attack again or where.
So right now we're driving north on I-5. We're in Irvine, California area. If we were to continue driving another 200 miles northwest from here, we would reach Santa Barbara. That's where we have 3 of the Southern California cases. The first one, the second one, and the 5th one.
Chapter 6, Sherry and Greg's story. The original Night Stalker attacked and murdered his 5th and 6th victims, Sherry Domingo and Greg Sanchez, in the quiet town of Santa Barbara, California, on July 27, 1981. Debbie was 15 years old at the time.
My name is Debbie Domingo McMullen, and when I was a teenager, my mom and her boyfriend were murdered by the Golden State Killer. When I was about 10 or so, we moved to the Santa Barbara area. And not very long after that, my dad and mom separated. Dad was settled in San Diego with my stepmom and her sons. And then my brother chose to live with my dad and stepmom as well. Within the first year or two after the divorce, life for the most part was just me and Mom. Santa Barbara is about midway through the state, right on the coast, and it's nestled kind of in between the shoreline and the foothills of a little mountain range. There's a bit of a Spanish influence, so you'll see a lot of kind of stucco-type homes and a lot of greenery, a lot of oak trees and palm trees and everything you can imagine in between. The ocean is just gorgeous. You can walk into different restaurants and shops, kind of the old historic parts of town. The soundtrack of my life includes music from The Eagles and Jim Croce and Firefall and, you know, this kind of easy listening 1970s kind of an atmosphere. We spent a lot of time together, just her and I. We liked to shop and we liked to go to the beach and we liked museums and the mission. It was just kind of like gal pals. She was very young and very pretty, very vibrant, very attractive. And we would be out somewhere and I'd yell out, "Hey, Mom." And heads would turn because they'd look at her and go, "Whoa, she's your mom?" Because she just had that kind of young air about her. When I was little, my mom was the ultimate homemaker. She made sure that our house was always clean and comfortable. She made clothes for us and Halloween costumes. And she cooked nearly everything from scratch. She baked beautifully. She was always either humming or singing something. I look back on it now and I think she did well. She did really well. I think she felt alone, but she made the best of it. She was an optimist. She dated a few guys the first year or two. There was nothing very remarkable about them. But within the first year or so, she met Greg Sanchez. And Greg was just too cool. He was wonderful. My mom and Greg would date exclusively for long periods of time. And then for some reason or another, they would split up. Greg was significantly younger than she was. She was 35 and he was 27. And Greg was, he was real. And I don't know how else to put that. There were a few of the guys that she dated that they always seemed like they were trying to show off. Oh, I've got this hot car, or oh, I've got this good job, or oh, I'm so good looking. And, or oh, if this gets serious, I might be your new stepdad. But Greg never did any of that. I remember whenever Greg was around, Mom seemed happy. Greg and I had this funny kind of joking relationship. He called me Deborah D. And, you know, he'd just be like, "Hey, Deborah D, are you ready for dinner?" And I'd say, "Greg, my name's not Deborah, it's Debbie." And he'd say, "No, it's all right, I can call you Deborah." He was the only one who ever got away with that. Physically, when you would look at my mom and Greg together, it was kind of like night and day because she was 5'4" and very, very petite. And Greg was at least 6 foot tall. Some said he was 6'4". He was very muscular. He was the epitome of tall, dark, and handsome. Dark brown hair, nice full mustache. His eyes sparkled. He was just handsome. His legs were like tree trunks. He played softball on a team with his brothers. And at some point, I remember seeing him, and he had the baseball pants on, but he didn't yet have the socks and the shoes on. And I remember looking and going, "What are you wearing capris for?" And he just laughed, and he says, "Deborah, these are my baseball pants." And I said, "What are you talking about?" I don't remember ever hearing the two of them talk about marriage, but there were hints along the way. And I think Greg wanted to be married. And my mom, she never really talked about it much, but looking back now, I think she was gun shy. I think the divorce was very, very painful for her. And I think that she loved Greg, and I think she was scared. As I got older, I started to get more and more kind of selfish and wrapped up into what I want. And there would be times that Mom and I would have arguments, and I would threaten, "No, I'm just going to leave. I'm just going to go live with Dad." I got to where I was pushing limits. I was breaking curfews. I was, I don't even like to admit this in public, but I was sexually active way too early. And I think my parents had reason to be concerned about my behavior. And any time that I was confronted or that they tried to put limits on me, I would just rebel against that and say, you know what, I'm making my own decisions. It's not your life, it's my life. By the time I was finishing up 10th grade, I was just about to turn 16, I started to get just this huge self